hppodcraft.com.
Brenda Alden was a product of that aseptic, faintly sadistic school of child rearing that is already a little old-fashioned. The vacationing parents on Moss Island liked her and held up her politeness and good manners as examples to their offspring. But the children themselves stayed away from her, scenting in her something waspish and irritable. She was tall for her age and lanky, with limp blonde hair. She always wore slacks. Monday began like all her days. She had breakfast, was told to keep her elbows off the table, helped with the dishes. Then she was told to go out and play. She sauntered slowly into the woods. The woods on Moss Island were scattered clumps of birch and denser stands of conifers. There were places where Brenda, if she tried hard, could have the illusion of a forest, and she liked that. In the western part of the island, there was a wide, deep excavation which people said had been a quarry. Nobody ever said what had been quarried out of it.
That was the opening of Brenda by Margaret St. Clair, straight out of Weird Tales from 1954, and we are covering it here on the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We are careening towards a full rebrand as Strange Studies of Strange Stories, but you can always find us on Patreon.
This is a follow-up to our interview with Ramsey Campbell last week, in which we briefly touched on this story. This one is in the Folio Book of Horror. It's a more recent book, and oh boy, this is from the Folio Society. Dangerous group of publishers. Dangerous to my bank account. Have you seen these books?
Oh yeah, they're gorgeous.
Amazing hardcovers. I want to buy their copy of Dracula, and I have like 7 copies of Dracula.
I know.
This Folio Book of Horror features illustrations from Corey Brickley and is a hit list of stories that we've already covered on this show.
Mm-hmm.
Fall of the House of Usher, The Yellow Wallpaper, Count Magnus, The White People, The Music of Eric Zahn, Smoke Ghost by Fritz Leiber, still the easiest title to say. 2 stories in there we haven't covered, though, are this one, Brenda, and The Bus by Shirley Jackson, which we'll be doing next week.
Yep.
So please, folks, pick it up, the Folio Book of Horror. Do it for Ramsey. You know, he spoke very highly of you all when he was on the show.
Yeah.
It's the least you could do. By the way, what a great guest.
Oh my God, I know. He is such an amazing guy.
Just fun to talk to. Thanks again to Jeremy Dyson for helping us set that up.
Oh yeah.
Now, we haven't covered anything by Margaret St. Clair yet on the show.
No.
Ramsey also spoke very highly of her, in addition to you listeners. In fact, he wrote an introduction to her book, The Hole in the Moon and Other Tales. So something else you might want to look out for.
Margaret St. Clair was born Eva Margaret Neely in Hutchinson, Kansas. In 1911, her father was a U.S. representative by the name of George A. Neely, but he died when she was 7.
Aww.
She was the only child. When she was 17, her mother moved them to California, and she went to UC Berkeley and got a master's degree in Greek classics. After college, she married Eric St. Clair and moved to El Sobrante, California, and she also bred dachshunds. And that's it. That's all I got on her.
All right, moving on.
No! No, she's got rad stuff. She and her husband were very well traveled. She was Wiccan, liked to go to nudist colonies. Huh, scandal.
Yeah, I think so. Well, that info is from a book about the rise of Wicca. It says in that book, it says in 1966, she and her husband were initiated into Wicca by Raymond Buckland, taking the craft names Froniga and Waylon. Froniga is a pretty cool name. Waylon, I was about to make fun of. It's kind of a lame name to choose if you can choose a craft name.
Sure,
you know,
yeah.
Your witch name. That I think you do that to keep people from knowing your true name because that's powerful, right?
Right.
And then also if you're in the quote-unquote broom closet about being Wiccan.
I've never heard that.
Yeah, you might use that name at your ceremonies and what have you. But like I say, I was going to make fun of Eric, her husband, except that I read this. He also published numerous short stories and magazine articles and was, quote, perhaps the leading American writer of children's stories about bears, having sold close to 100 of them.
Bears?
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think I work in a specific niche, but...
Margaret's first published story was Rocket Limbo, published in Fantastic Adventures, November of 1946. By the late 40s, she had published at least 140 stories. She did a series of stories about Una and Jick, the comic misadventures of a housewife of the future.
You are my future wife. What are you doing? There you go.
In her autobiography, she says, the stories were ostensibly set in the idealized future, but cast a satirical look at post-war domestic life, with its focus on acquiring labor-saving household devices and keeping up with the Joneses. St. Clair would later remark that Una and Jick stories were not especially popular with fans, who were, then as now, a rather humorless bunch. The light tone of the stories seemed to offend readers and make them think I was making fun of them.
Make them think. I think she probably was. I read that when the World Science Fiction Convention was held in Oakland in 1954, the Oakland Tribune highlighted St. Clair as a local author by asking her to provide a, quote, menu of the future. They thought, a woman writing sci-fi, she must know what we all want to eat in the future.
Oh, God.
Weirdly, the first entry was a dish called you.
In the 1950s, she continued writing like a demon, with almost all of her stories appearing in the magazine of fantasy and science fiction under the pen name of Idris Seabright. That's a great name.
Yeah.
Three of her short stories were adapted for television, including this story, which was an episode of Night Gallery, and I tried to find it, but I could not.
That's too bad. I think it is available in the U.S. for streaming in a couple of different places, but I only read about that this morning when I was looking at notes, so I haven't had a chance to watch it yet. I looked it up. It's season 2, episode 7.
Yep.
Also features a piece called Midnight Never Ends, which was written by Rod Serling.
Mm-hmm.
The Brenda adaptation, from what I can tell, is pretty faithful to this story. The creature looks very much like The Heap. Folks, if you have seen it or watch it after you listen to this episode, write in and tell us about it for the comments show. We'll just, because I'll probably have seen it by then. We did an episode on Theodore Sturgeon's story called It, if you will recall. That was episode 483. We're not going to talk much about the Swamp Thing-esque nature of this in this story because we did lots of talking about Swamp Thing, Man Thing. The Heap, I believe, came out in the 40s in comics. So go to episode 483 if you want to hear about that. But in this story we're looking at, it is another prototypical Moss Man. By the way, we're talking about Night Gallery. I wanted to call some attention to our reader today, which we blew past in the beginning. We are lucky to be joined by the talented Nicole Knudsen. Nicole is the producer and voice of the tour guide for the Godfrey Audio Guide, which is an award-winning podcast that I think our audience would dig right up, especially if you're a Night Gallery fan. The Godfrey Audio Guide is a fiction podcast that blends horror, sci-fi, and art history, both real and imagined, in the guise of a museum audio tour. You know, you put those headphones on and go around a museum. That's such a great device for a podcast. Yeah. We'll link out in the show notes. It's awesome. I think folks should check it out.
Thank you, Nicole. During her life, St. Clair wrote 8 novels. Her first was called Sign of the Labrius in 1963, which is a post-apocalyptic story with some Wiccan elements. Her last 3 novels made a loose trilogy set in Northern California in the near future, and they sound pretty awesome. In The Dolphins of Altair in 1967, dolphins and 3 human compatriots stage a war on mankind by creating earthquakes and polar melting.
You don't even have to tell me how they do it. Dolphins declaring war on people and having 3 friends. I like that there's a number there. They got 3 humans.
Three humans. And then The Shadow People, 1969, a young male narrator in Berkeley descends into a mysterious underworld to rescue his abducted girlfriend.
Yeah, could use some dolphins.
And lastly, The Dancers of Noyo, 1973, draws on Pomo lore as a young male narrator in a California largely depopulated by plague goes on a grail journey along Highway 101.
I like that. Sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds pretty cool. And the last of these 2 novels, the narrator's quest climaxes in an experience of transcendent enlightenment.
There's so many good books to read out there.
Oh my God.
When I think of all the time people spend scrolling through social media rather than reading, it makes me weep for humanity. You know, I'm trying to put a note on my phone that you could be reading right now every time that I'm doing that. You know, just what wasted time.
Sinclair died in 1995. Also, this story is rad. And as you said, it was published in Weird Tales in 1954.
We've linked out to the Weird Tales PDF from the Internet Archive for this story, so you can read it in its original home. Or you can get the Folio Book of Horror and impress your friends.
Yes.
Let's get into it.
This story begins with a girl, Brenda, who is on a small island staying in her family's summer home.
I assume that this is the real Moss Island, which is in upstate New York. It's a popular rock climbing site, but I'm not sure if it is the same one because I don't know how much property's on the island. It's a small island, but there are definitely lots of huge potholes and quarry type things there. Obviously, the name Moss Island conveys a lot about the location and kind of tips what we might encounter in the story as well.
There are only a few other families around. The other parents liked her because she was polite, but the kids didn't like her because she's a bit weird. She's tall for her age, which I think is around 11 or 12, but they don't really say.
It's pre-high school. So, I think she's in that junior high change of life. You know, you're going through puberty and things are a little odd at that time. She's polite because she's a product of what we heard at the top, that aseptic, faintly sadistic school of child rearing that is already a little old-fashioned. The word aseptic really struck me, you know, meaning clean, sterile. In this context of child rearing, I think it means without warmth or the messiness you would get from a hug, physical contact. The faintly sadistic part, I think, might hint at abuse, but I think it's more about that denial of affection that's implied by the aseptic part. Like those horrible experiments with monkeys where they deny them their mothers and then they wind up chewing their own limbs up.
Oh, Jesus.
The mammalian love instinct is really what makes mammals successful as a species, caring for our young. And the denial of that really basic survival strategy causes a lot of harm.
Yeah.
Psychologically. And when I looked up that Night Gallery episode, I saw a lot of debate about what this story is about or what does it even mean, because it is a little ambiguous. But I think Miss St. Clair is giving you a pretty strong clue in that first sentence.
Near Brenda's house is a small wooded area and an old quarry. On a Monday, she's out playing in the wooded area and smells something rotten. And this is our first tip that the kid is a bit different. When it first met her nose, Brenda's face wrinkled up with a distaste. But after a moment, her face relaxed. She inhaled, not without eagerness. She decided to try to find the source of the smell. Sometimes she liked to smell and look at rotten things. She follows the smell and she sees a man?
He was not a tramp. He was not one of the summer people. Brenda knew at once that he was not like any other man she had ever seen. His skin was not black or brown, but of an inky grayness. His body was blobbish and irregular, as if it had been shaped out of the clots of soap and grease that stop up kitchen sinks. He held a dead bird in one crude hand. The rotten smell was welling out of him.
Bam, we're right in there with this creature. I think the early presence tells you this is not a monster that we're winding up to. This is not the witch held in the in the cellar that, you know, is going to be sort of the climax of the story. It's going to be about a relationship.
This is different than Swamp Thing or those other creatures. Like, those usually had plant or elements in it. She just describes this thing as having inkish gray skin with that's blobbish and irregular.
Yeah.
And they talk about his teeth later. You can see he's got white teeth.
Right.
Which is extra creepy. So what the hell is this thing?
I don't know.
And we never find out, really.
No.
This man reaches out an arm to her, and then she runs, and then he chases after her. I think I would have called it an it, but she specifically calls it a him and refers to it as a man.
Yeah.
Seems like it's important.
I think it is, yeah. And that's what I was trying to touch on with Ramsey in that last episode about, you know, his story and how, and this story and the woman against this sort of de-evolved male thing. It stumbles after her, extends an arm toward her. I got the impression that its gait was something like a mummy in a Scooby-Doo episode. You know, it's easily avoided by a spry child, you know, or an intelligent Great Dane. Something that you can lead on. Stop, look at it, see what it's doing, run a little more, investigate.
Well, she's able to keep ahead of him, and she stops. Then her lips curved in what was almost a smile. She runs over near the quarry, and it follows. Now, the thing seems like it doesn't like the sunlight, and it keeps its head down as it runs after her. She picks up a few pine cones as part of her plan that she's formulated. She goes on the opposite side of the big quarry. She throws a pine cone into the pit. And the creature, which is hiding its eyes from the light, is listening and can hear her and is trying to find her. So when she throws another pine cone, the man thing goes into the pit and falls without a sound. Now she peeks over and she sees this rotten smelling man is trapped. It tries to climb out, but it stumbles back in. It says his blobbish limbs were extraordinarily inept and awkward.
The other kids don't like Brenda because she's, quote, waspish and irritable. Wasp, I don't think, is a reference to her race.
No.
It means that, like a wasp, she might sting you.
Yeah.
I think what that is shorthand for, though, really is intelligent and independent, curious, because we are talking about gender roles. This is a girl who saw a monster in the woods and trapped it to study rather than go tell an adult.
She teases him a bit. She says, you can't get out. After she's done with that, she just leaves him there. And when she gets home, her father chews her out for being late, but she doesn't care. She goes to bed and sleeps well.
Mm-hmm.
What?
It's like she's comforted by this a little bit in a weird way.
Yeah.
And I think it's like she's got something that's all her own. right now. And the phrase that struck me is it says she hugged her secret to herself all the rest of the day. And I don't think that verb hug is an accident. It links to that aseptic raising. A muck monster trapped in a quarry is the opposite of aseptic. That's gross and messy and real. And also, though, is it slightly sadistic what she's doing?
Yeah.
You know, the thing reached for her and followed. We don't know that it was trying to hurt her. It maybe needed help. You know, the only monstrous behavior it revealed was that it was eating a bird. Or at least holding a dead bird. Yeah. But I was doing that last night making dinner. You know, I eat chicken like I've got something against it. And so, you know, my point being that she's maybe both rebelling against and imitating her parents, which is a complex behavior that most people do.
You made the assumption, and then you corrected yourself, that he was eating the bird. We don't know he was eating the bird. He was just holding a bird. All it says, and that's, you know, obviously.
It just says he was holding it. And in fact, there's evidence later that he's not eating these things.
So the next day, she goes to see her friend Charles, who's not really her friend, but he's a kid who doesn't actively dislike her. She asks him if he wants to see something funny, scary, queer.
He had given her a cast-off snake skin in the past. So she thinks, this guy's like me maybe a little bit, and this might be something interesting to him. She's trying to befriend another oddball.
And he's a bit curious about this until she touches him on the arm. It says, up until that moment, Charles might have accompanied her, but the dryness intensity of her touch on his, the touch of a person who has never received or given a pleasant physical contact, repelled him. Ugh, it's heartbreaking. He tells her to bug off, and she does.
Whereas this problem was implied before, here the author makes it very explicit. This is something that maybe Margaret, the author, knows intimately herself, having lost her father at seven, being an only child. Those biographical details might play into this. When you have a deficit of attention and love as a child, you do carry that into the world with you.
Yeah.
The thing about it is it compounds itself because you didn't learn something that perhaps other people did. And that causes you to be further rejected by them, as we see just happened. Because you're not doing things right. People sense that. And so they might just not like you the way that the other kids don't like Brenda. And I think that that's why we see, you know, the outcast here is trying to find solace with another outcast, as happens in society. She's trying to use this devolved man as an object to get the attention of this other boy, you know, who gave her the snake skin. But he casts her off himself after that touch. Ugh, she's different.
Yeah.
He's not interested in the man, but his disinterest in the muck monster is a little like her own parents' disinterest in her.
Back home, Brenda's dad is working on a building project. He's installing a barbecue pit.
He puts her to work shoveling dirt, mixing concrete. So they do have some time together. But I thought it was interesting that when you see her doing an activity with her dad, what are they doing? They're civilizing the environment. They're not making a campfire. They're building a barbecue pit, which means you pour concrete into the earth and make it more like the inside than the outside.
So after working, she hangs out in a hammock and wonders about the guy in the pit. And she leaves to check on him, even though it's almost supper time. He's there, just sitting in the pit. His head moves up a bit when she comes around, but then he just goes back to sitting there, not moving.
I felt bad for him.
Me too. She noticed that there are two long boards by this pit that would help him get out. They're heavy, but she's able to move them in. And she's a bit nervous because she has to get kind of close to this thing. But when she gets them in, the man doesn't move. And she shouts at it, but it still doesn't move. And then as the sun sets, the shadows fall. And once in the darkness of the shadows, the man seems to have more life. And he moves towards those boards. As she can see, he's actually getting out. She runs home before it escapes.
So interesting that she provides the means of escape, yet doesn't try to control what the thing does once it's out, or even stick around to watch what it does. It's that messy potential of it that's interesting to her. And you might suspect, I think they might have put this in the Night Gallery adaptation, but you might suspect that she kind of wonders, I wonder, you know, if this thing will do violence to my family. Let's find out. She's not protective of them.
The next day she stays out of the woods and hangs around the house.
At one point, her mother sends her out to help her father again, who sends her back, quote, saying that he had got to a place in his construction where she could only be in the way. So again, it's like when I needed someone to help me mix the concrete, but don't hang out and see the completion of this. Just get out of my way.
She overhears her mother talking to her father about a neighbor, Elizabeth, who was telling her some gray slime-covered guy came into their house and stole their roast chicken. Stunk up the house, something fierce. And her father brushes it off, saying that Liz is being hysterical. Brenda is caught eavesdropping on this conversation, and her dad tells her off.
Elizabeth says, he only took the roast chicken, and it hadn't even been eaten. It was only torn into pieces. So this thing might not even know what food is, or... Yeah. I mean, I don't think it does, because later, it's obviously not eating when it's trapped, which we'll get to, but...
Yeah.
You know, when she says, hey, Elizabeth sounded insane, and he says, she's probably hysterical. Boy, there's a loaded word that definitely is associated with gender.
Yeah.
And it's such a real thing, this happening, dismissing the concerns of women, that even male writers put it in all their stories.
Yeah.
The woman's always right in the story.
Now, Brenda's thinking about this guy. What is his deal? And she's fascinated by him. She wants to write in her journal, but she knows that her mom will read it, so she doesn't. And she finds some loose paper, and she writes down questions. She writes down, one, where did he come from? It says here, I think that he came to Moss Island from the mainland. I think he came over one night last month when the tide was so low. I think he came here by accident, she erased, by mistake.
I like the humanity of her correcting her things as she's going, but that specific one, I mean, she does something that her dad didn't do when he wrote off their neighbor, which is attribute some intelligence to the other bee.
Yes.
He didn't come over here by accident. He came here by mistake, meaning he probably wanted to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. She asks, why does he stay on the island? And responds, I think because he cannot swim. The water would wash him away. And then she asks, what kind of man is he? I think he is not like other people, not like us. He's a different kind of man. He is not like us because he likes dead things to eat. Things that have been dead for much, she raced, for a long time. And I think that is why he came to Moss Island in the first place, hunting. He is old. He's been the way he is for a long time. I think he wants to be born.
And what do you think about that line?
I don't know. Even after reading the story a couple times over, I'm still not exactly sure what that means.
I don't think that we're meant to know that it means a specific thing, but obviously this is a character who herself is waiting to be born.
Sure.
She, thus far, is defined by the way that she reacts to the raising that she's getting and by the society that she's living in here on Moss Island. She doesn't have her own agency yet.
She then takes all the writings, rips them up, and flushes them down the toilet.
Always a good strategy with journals. I mean that. Write that stuff down and get rid of it. You're never going to reread it.
So that night, she's awakened by voices. She creeps out and smells that smell of the slime man, and it's so strong that she feels lightheaded. Her mom and dad are talking in intense but hushed tones. Her dad tells her to call Liz and have her husband Jim bring over his gun. Her mother says to keep it down. If Brenda saw this, she would flip out.
I want you to call Liz and apologize. No, he doesn't say that.
No, he doesn't say that. It says here, Brenda's eyes widened. Were her parents really solicitous for her? Were they afraid she'd be afraid?
That's an interesting thing for her to get excited about.
Yeah.
So aseptic that she goes, wow, they actually are worried that something might happen to me? She's surprised by that.
She creeps a bit further and she can see that her father has the slime man pinned with a flashlight, with a beam of light. It's somehow keeping it from moving. And her mom tells her dad that Jim is coming over with a gun. Now, Jim shows up with the gun. He says that it's the same man that he saw at his house, but he doesn't think the gun's going to do anything. He demonstrates by shooting the slime man, and the bullet has no effect on it. It doesn't even make it flinch. But Jim has an idea. Fire. So they make a torch, and they drive it out of the house. And it says, whenever he slowed and tried to face them, his head lowered, his teeth gleamed. They thrust the bundle of burning rags in his face. Is it trying to communicate with them?
We don't know. It can deal, you know, it can't deal with light and fire. That's all they learn about it. So they go with that. Force it out. Force the outcast out. We don't understand it.
So outside the house, the men are at a loss what to do with the slime man. And Brenda is eavesdropping, but she's still in the house and can't really hear what they're saying. But she can hear the word quarry. The men come back to the cottage at daybreak. Brenda sneaks out and she goes to the quarry and she sees that in the bottom of the quarry is now a huge pile of rocks in the center of it. And she climbs down and gets on top of the pile.
A great mound of rock had been piled up in the center. The men of Moss Island must have worked hard all day to pile up so much rock. She slid down the sides and clambered up the heap in the center. What had become of him? Was he under the mound? It's sort of an amazing tactic they've used. Bury it and don't think about it anymore.
Like people do with so many problems.
Yeah.
It says here, she listened. She could only hear the beating of her heart and then far down, a long way off, a rustle within the heap, like that made of a mole's soft paws.
Creepy stuff. You know, yeah. It's a little like the tiny sounds the immortal witch was making in the dark when they were walling her back up in Chilton Castle.
Right.
What is this thing thinking and doing in there?
Yeah.
No follow-up from anybody on this?
Yeah.
It's just, like you say, like so many things. This thing is confusing and scary, so I'm going to cover it up and just not learn about it at all.
Yeah.
It's dealt with.
Not deal with it. Not have anybody else deal with it. Don't take any responsibility. Just keep moving. After that, things changed. Brenda's dad had to go back to work and was only on the island on the weekends. Brenda got popular with the other kids, but she got unruly with her mother. She would spend all day out and about with the kids, causing trouble. It says, her new energy seemed inexhaustible. The physical feats that had once repelled her drew her irresistibly. She tumbled, climbed, dove, chinned herself, did splits and cartwheels. The other children watched her admiringly and applauded. For the first time in her life, she tasted the pleasure of leadership.
Supercharged, super popular. What do you think this change is about?
I don't know. I feel like that there is a metaphor going on here, but I'm not quite grasping it.
I think that it possibly she saw that this creature, as a result of it being different, was then buried under the stones and left. And that fate is for any of us who don't take the opportunity to step out. You know, you've got to push. You got to break out of that that cage.
Yeah.
If you don't want to be forgotten, perhaps that could be a metaphor for it. You know, because she really goes. It says she breaks out of her. She got unruly with her mother. The cage that her parents have put her in. She breaks out of.
The parents who thought she was an example of good behavior said that she was now getting their kids into mischief. At the end of the summer, she left back for home and school. There, the kids were all into her as well. A year passes. And the parents leave Brenda at school for the first part of the summer, but when she returns, she's gone through puberty and she now has a feminine shape. It says she did not go at once to the cairn in the quarry. She often thought of it, but she felt a sweet reluctance, an almost tender disinclination toward going. It could wait. August was well advanced before she visited the mound.
I was curious that she was like waiting to do it. You know, why wouldn't you go there right away?
She goes to the mound and she presses her ear to the rock pile.
There was silence. Was he? But of course he couldn't be dead. Hi, she called softly, her lips against the rock. Hi, I've come back. It's me. The scrabble began far down and seemed to come nearer, but there was too much rock in the way. Brenda sighed. Poor old thing, she said. Her tone was rueful. You want to be born, don't you? And you can't get out. It's too bad. The scrabbling continued. Brenda, after a moment, stretched herself out against the rock. The sun was warm. The heat from the stones beat up lullingly against her body. She lay in drowsy contentment for a long time, listening to the noises within the mound. The sun began to wester. The cool of evening roused her. She sat up. The air was utterly silent. There were no bird calls anywhere. The only sounds came from within the mound. Brenda leaned forward quickly so that her long hair fell over her face. I love you, she said softly to the rock. I'll always love you. You're the only one I could ever love. She halted. The scrabbling within had risen to a crescendo. She laughed. Then she drew a long, wavering sigh. Be patient, she said. Someday I'll let you out, I promise. We'll be born together, you and I.
And that's the end of the story.
Yeah.
So I was saying that, you know, she's been born at this point because she is displaying all this personality. She's passed through the trials of puberty, but she herself does not think she's yet been born.
Mm.
Yeah, why?
Maybe this thing represents part of herself, part of something that she doesn't like, and she's gotten rid of it. She wants to reconcile that part with herself. And once she does reconcile that, she will be who she's supposed to be, I'm guessing.
That's definitely a reading of it for sure. You know, that beast in the cage represents that unloved, unwanted child that she was. She ran way in the other direction away from the cage to identify a unique part of her personality, to do stunts and be crazy. But at some point, there has to be a synthesis, accepting who she was with who she's become, and then she'll be a full person. Maybe. Seems like a very modern 21st century reading of it. I'm not entirely sure what she was getting at in the 50s, but I love this story.
Yeah, it's really awesome.
I think this should be taught in school because it is hard to figure it out, and I bet you would really have a lot of unique interpretations of it from different students.
I recommend digging up the old weird tales and giving it a check. It's also creepy in interesting ways and also gives you a lot to think about, and that's great writing. That's literature.
Yeah, I can see why Ramsey would have picked it out
for
the book that he edited, the Folio Book of Horror Stories. Again, see if you can grab that one. If you got the cash, it's pretty amazing. Yeah. And it's got a lot of stories we've covered in it.
I want to thank our reader.
Yes, Nicole Knudsen, thank you so much again. Nicole is the producer and voice of the tour guide for the Godfrey Audio Guide. It's an awesome podcast. I really recommend that folks who listen to us go listen to that because I think you'll really like it. Nicole's great, and I'm so glad to have her on the show. Thank you, Nicole.
And also, we've got some patrons that they deserve some thanking.
They do, and I'm going to start by thanking Patricia.
I'd like to thank Jeff Whittem.
Peter Larson. Hey, what's up, man? Hey. Thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Joyce Stevens.
Joyce. There's not enough people named Joyce anymore.
That was my grandmother's name.
I just really like that name. There needs to be more Joyces. Ken, thank you.
I'd like to thank Christopher Comery.
I'd like to thank Michael Krzak.
Hey, Sam Houston, thank you.
John Walker, thank you.
And lastly, Thomas Rao, thank you kindly.
You guys are the best. Thanks for supporting the show. We're going to be back next week with The Bus by Shirley Jackson. That's going to be our 600th episode. Wow. We're going to have a 601 to finish out the month, and I'm not sure what it is yet. It might be another grab from this Folio Book of Horror Stories. I'm not entirely sure, but please tune in for that. It's going to be extra special. Thanks again, everybody, for tuning in. For now, this is Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies of Strange Stories,
the HP Lovecraft Literary Podcast, here on hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.